Please make sure that you sign in. For those who signed in advance, we tried something different this time. We had a link that I sent out to the medical email list for advanced registration. And I think a lot of people took advantage of that. I'm very happy that they did. If you signed in there, you don't need to do anything else. If you did not sign in there, then please send me a note in the chat. You can do it privately. You can do it open. It doesn't matter. In the event that you didn't receive the emails in advance for this, that means I don't have your email address on the list. Please make sure to include your email address when you sign in, so that you'll be able to, number one, get the follow-up from this class. Number two, so that you'll be able to get notice of future classes. And number three, for those who want credit, we need to have your name and email address, obviously. And also, something very, very important. For the sake of our accreditation, we also need to circulate a survey from this session. So Barry is going to send out an email with it. Those of you who signed up in advance actually should be receiving it somewhere around 8 o'clock today. Those of you who did not sign in advance will get it a little bit later than that. But it's very important that you fill out the survey. And hey, fill it out frankly. You know, you don't have to just say nice things. I think it's important for the sake of improving what we do. Finally, those of you who have been in classes with me before are aware. I love to be able to speak to people. I don't share screen. I like to be able to actually see people. So if you're okay turning on your video, please do so. Because it's a lot easier to, you know, present a session when you're actually talking to people. And in terms of comments during the program, please, if you have a question, just say so. If you want to be polite, you can do the raise hand thing on Zoom, and I'll be keeping my eye for it. The only thing I would ask that you not do is put questions in the chat, because I really don't like having to monitor the chat while also having conversations with people. That becomes very, very difficult. I'm going to mute everybody by default, but you will be able to unmute yourself. I already see a question up in the chat from Elizabeth. Go ahead. Or that might have been a mistake. Elizabeth? Don't see. Okay. So, let's get started.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So sorry. My friends are trying to get in and they can't get in. Is it too late for them? Just registered.
It's not too late. They can get in. I mean, I'm not seeing anybody in the waiting room. What message are they getting?
I'm not quite sure. They're just not getting in. So I'm going to send them again, link again and see.
Go for it. Oh, sorry.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Okay. All right. So let's start. Infection control for doctors and dentists in the COVID era. And this is something that a lot of people have been discussing. I've heard from a lot of people, certainly. If you take a look at the top of the source sheet, and one more time, I'm going to send out the link for the source sheet to everybody. If you're not on the email list for these classes yet, once you sign in, you will be. And that's good, because then you'll get notification in advance, and you'll get the materials in advance. So if you don't have them, again, I just put the link in the chat. Here's our agenda. The balance between protecting the public and enabling the practice of medicine is tricky during a pandemic. Infection protocols are necessarily strict and uniform, but they open the door to serious ethical questions. If a patient or professional is infected, how should the public be informed? What is the reporting duty of a staff member who believes that safety protocols have been breached, but no infection has taken place? Does a medical professional have leeway in applying protocols if she judges that they may be safely adjusted in a way that would enable stronger patient care? That was the overall agenda that we started with the following objective. By the end of this session, participants will, number one, be able to describe the ethical and halachic considerations relating to infection risk in patients and oneself. Number two, understand the halachic perspective on adherence to guidance and protocols from professional bodies. And number three, be able to discuss the reporting duties and responsibilities of themselves, staff members, and patients. It's a big field. There's an awful lot to talk about. But hopefully it will be educational, maybe a little entertaining also along the way, who knows. And we God willing, will come out with not only credit, but also a richer understanding of halacha, as well as duties of medical professionals. One other note I should have mentioned in the beginning. Many of you already know, usually these sessions, when it's, you know, not a pandemic, are done in person. And this session would have been at Shari Shamayim Synagogue. And I'm grateful to them for their willingness to host. And I look forward to being able to return there to have these sessions with you in person. As convenient as Zoom is, learning in person is incomparable in terms of the quality of the learning, for myself certainly, when you're with people in the same room. Okay. So, two disclaimers that are important to make as we enter into this. Number one, nothing I say here is intended as a practical halachic ruling. I always insist that people should ask their rabbi their halachic questions. It's important for many reasons that are beyond the scope of our discussion right now. I think the discussion is important to have, but I think that practical guidance should come from your rabbi. That's number one. Number two, I'm going to be working with mainstream medical opinion regarding masks and social distancing. I am well aware that there are people who do not agree. Okay, when we get to discuss alternative medicine in February, we can have that conversation. But right now, I am working with what I think is considered mainstream medical advice. And I noted for you on the sheet, the first three sources of the sheet, that speak to how Jewish law establishes the medical norm. The number one, in source number one, from Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, writing in 18th century Italy. He was citing someone from the generation before his. They saying that we determine expertise as based on a person's licensing. In other words, if there is a supervisory board that determines and accredits who is able to practice medicine, that's what you need in order to be considered an expert from the perspective of Jewish law. That's number one. And that's an idea that actually goes back to Talmudic times before there was such a thing as communal licensing. That's principle number one. The public certification is what matters. Number two, source number two, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg says you work with whatever is considered the standard of care, the accepted medical approach. He's talking there about a doctor who intends to heal, and he says treat the patient according to whatever the standard of care is. So we go with what people popularly do. And finally, in a case of doubt, we work with majority opinion. And that's seen in source number three, where we require a recognizable majority. He talks about polling doctors and getting a two-thirds opinion. All of this is material we're going to have to come back to when we talk about alternative medicine in February, God willing. But right now, I'm just bringing it here to explain why I'm taking it as a given. You know, one of our cases is going to be, what if some staff member in a medical practice is wearing a mask that isn't fitted properly? I'm taking it as a given that that's a requirement. And again, I know not everybody's on the same page, but for the purpose of this session, that's what I'm working with. Clear?
Question.
Yes.
Question. You'll probably get to this in your next session, but so if the public votes this person as an expert, then if, you know, the public decides that, I don't know, the anti-vax view is the thing now, then is that, like, supported by the Ma'aril?
So you are correct that that's going to be the conversation in February. How much weight do we give public opinion in such matters? It will actually tangentially be something we end up discussing here, but only tangentially. That is a major focus. It's a great question. But it's not for right now. Okay. So we have four vignettes. I'm going to introduce just the first one, and then we're going to do the discussion that relates to it. Actually, you know what? I'm going to read out all four. Let's do it that way, because it'll help in terms of framing overall where we're going. So take a look on your sheet at source number one, please. Sarah, a dentist, receives notification from Toronto Public Health that a patient, Jill, who came in for a routine cleaning, has tested positive for COVID-19. The visit took place 4 days ago. The patient was asymptomatic at the time. No aerosol-generating procedures were conducted. And what I mean by including that is, in theory at any rate, they had lots of protections in place during the patient's visit, such that it will be unlikely or less likely that COVID would be spread. So they had barriers and all the things that you would hope to see. Public health wants a list of patients who were present in the facility when Jill was present. But Sarah feels the great majority of them were not at any risk. What should Sarah tell public health about the other patients, according to public health protocols and according to Jewish law? And is there any concern that this could lead to harm for Jill by having this reported? So I'm actually not going to call for answers to this yet. I'm going to go through all four, and then we're going to come back to the first one. So that's our first question. What should Sarah, the practitioner, divulge? Second, Jonathan, a new receptionist at a family medicine practice, notices that one of the staff members wears a poorly fitted mask. There are visible paths of airflow to and from his nose and mouth. Jonathan does not know the staff member well, so he discusses the situation with the physician who runs the practice. The physician offers an excuse on behalf of the staff member and does not take any corrective action. Please don't be upset at me for the scenario. It's a scenario, that's all it is. I am very grateful to our healthcare workers and do not want to in any way, shape, or form say anything negative, but it's a vignette, okay? What steps should Jonathan take to respond to this, according to public health protocols and according to Jewish law? That's going to be our second case. Third case, flipping the page. In a May 26, 2020 directive, and in further detail on June 15th, the Ontario Ministry of Health directed physicians to begin seeing patients in person for deferred, elective, and non-essential services. With the announcements we're expecting tomorrow, I'm not so sure where this is going. Nonetheless, as of those dates, that was the policy. Rodney, a pediatrician, feels that he should not yet see patients in person out of concern for the health of his pregnant wife. What would the Ministry of Health and Jewish law say about Rodney's wish to decline to see patients in person at this stage? Okay, so far we have our first case. The question is, what do you tell public health about patients who were there at the same time as a patient who tested positive? Our second question, the issue of a staff member at a practice whose mask is not fit properly. Do you report that? The third question is, public health says you should start seeing patients for elective services, non-essential services, but you as a practitioner feel you are vulnerable and therefore you don't want to do that. And then our fourth and last case, and I see a lot of people have joined, so I'm just going to, again, repost the link to the source sheet. In a May 26, 2020 directive, and in further detail on June 15th, the Ontario Ministry of Health directed physicians to begin seeing patients for deferred, elective, and non-essential services. The ministry specified that wherever possible, in-person visits should be replaced by other interactions. Samantha, a family physician, conducts routine physicals via telemedicine, but believes that she should see her geriatric patients in person to be certain to detect any health problems, as well as to provide them with stronger emotional support during the pandemic. Samantha and her staff are very careful about PPE, clean the office regularly, and strictly monitor their own health. And Samantha insists that her patients travel to their appointments in private vehicles and make no stops en route to the appointment or en route home. What would the Ministry of Health and Jewish Law say about this, about her encouraging the geriatric patients to have in-person physicals? Those are our four cases. So coming back to the first one, and here I'll pause for a moment just to ask those who came in, if you did not register in advance for this year, for this program, please make sure to send me your name in the chat, certify you were here, and your email address if you're not already getting the emails about these classes. So what would you say about our first scenario, the one in which we're talking about what the dentist should report about patients who were there at the same time as Jill, who tested positive. What's your feeling on this question? Rose.
So this to me is actually the easiest. You have to, it doesn't matter what you think or what you feel, there is a period of time that you're infective and you have to report. It doesn't matter how your emotions are. It's just, to me, it's very clear cut. There's no black, white. It's not gray at all. We have to report possibilities of a physician. You can't say, I feel that she wasn't infected. I wish to feel that other patients. I mean, that's my, I think,
okay.
No question.
So you may end up putting somebody in quarantine or isolation for, you know, a 2-week period.
Yes.
You know that. And you have no mercy.
Oh, 100%. I think that especially because it's highly contagious, because of the fact that we know that the numbers, I mean, speak for themselves, and if everybody takes proper precautions, you can't...
Okay.
You can say they can be tested, there can be another approach, but you have to inform. You cannot not inform the patient and put it upon your
Right. Now, the reason I ask the question and the reason I push is because several weeks ago, I was at a Minion and later found out that somebody there had tested positive. I happened to know who it was. We were across a very large room. We had no contact with each other whatsoever. I was wearing a mask, they were wearing a mask, and so on, and I ended up being labeled a close contact. Earned myself 2 weeks in isolation plus a trip for a COVID test. So I'm asking, would you have had mercy on me?
You know...
It's all right.
Ellen, where's Ellen Warner? He's brilliant. Ellen, hi, Ellen. The thing is this. You have to also look at this. I mean, how you define a close contact. So...
Correct.
Right? So for me, if they're in my office, it's not that the distance, right? There are walls, there are things you touch. So an office scenario is not like if you're in, for example, a synagogue. I don't want to say that it's allowed or not allowed, but say a huge space where you are 20 feet away from that person and there's been a case of COVID. Then you could say, well, at that point, I would personally do 2 COVID tests. If you're COVID negative on both tests, then I would give you mercy. But in a doctor's office or in a medical office or in a dental office, the spaces are tiny.
So the 6 feet is not necessarily the definition. We're going to get to some of the standards. We'll talk about that. But Ellen, you were going to say?
Not listening. We'll tell you about, aerosol versus droplet infection.
Unless right, we, you know, Rose?
Droplet infection is infection.
Sorry. We got a lot to talk about.
Obviously, I feel about
that. Yes.
Esther, who also knows me well, I
haven't
changed.
Okay. We have a lot to say, so I'm going to actually go a little further, unless anyone has something particular to respond to the first vignette.
Rose brought me into this. I'm not brilliant by any means, but I can tell you I'm now in quarantine from work because I left and went to the U.S. I stayed with my son who's vaccinated. I didn't leave. I was probably safer staying there than I would have been just walking around in the Christmas season here in Toronto. But the problem is for public health, there are rules, and the rules have to be very broad, and you can't change them for everyone, even though for individuals, they make absolutely no sense. I guess that Judaism is a little more nuanced, and according to halacha, there may be different attitudes here, but you just have to make something broad that works for most people, even though a lot of individuals are going to get, like, hurt, quote-unquote, in the process.
Right. So we're gonna talk about exactly that, and that's an ideal segue. So I thank you very much, Alan. Yes.
Are the 4 days in this vignette, is that intentional? Because we know that it's 2 or 3 days for COVID.
So it was intentional to say 4 days. But I don't remember anymore why. I remember that I wrote it up with 4 days in particular, but I don't remember why at this point. There was 4 days for a reason. It could be because I was allowing for time for symptoms to evolve. It could be that that's why I did it. Okay. So here's an important overarching point which touches on what Ellen said and really affects how we view all of the different vignettes. And that is the issue of personal discretion and professional discretion in Judaism in cases of uncertainty. All of these questions fundamentally involve uncertainty. The question is not, how can I break down the factors in this case and figure out which rule should apply? The problem is that the cases themselves are unclear. In the first vignette, how much danger are the other patients facing? Does that danger outweigh the challenges they're going to experience if they are labeled a close contact? In the second question, how risky is the mask of this staff member that's not fit properly? You can't give a definite answer. It's uncertain. The third one, how dangerous would it be for this fellow who has a pregnant wife to see patients? And then the fourth one, how great a need is there for these geriatric patients to be seen in person, and does it outweigh the potential danger to them and to the practitioner? All of these are questions fundamentally of uncertainty. So we have in Judaism various principles for adjudicating in cases of doubt, right? Can someone give me an example of a principle in Judaism for how we determine the law in a case of uncertainty?
Finding a piece of non-kosher meat on the street in front of nine butchers, one kosher, nine non-kosher, that type of thing?
Yeah, well, so what are the rules, though? And I'm asking for a case. I'm asking for the rule. Give me an example of a rule. We follow the majority, right? As the Torah says, Acharei Rabim Lahatot, you follow the majority. Majority may mean the majority of opinions on something. Majority may mean the majority, like what Manny just described, the application to this case, which I think Jack actually mentioned. The case in which you find a piece of meat and you know that there are nine kosher butcher stores and one non-kosher butcher store or vice versa, and you'll say, well, it probably came from the majority. We sometimes deal with doubt by saying, well, it depends on what the issue is. Is the issue a biblical law or is the issue a rabbinic law? If the issue is a biblical law, we might be more strict. If the issue is a rabbinic law, we might be more lenient. Sometimes we do it based on appeal to authority. You have a case of doubt, so go to the judge, and the judge is the one who's supposed to resolve it. It's funny, I actually got in the mail the other day a book that I had just ordered called The Birth of Doubt by Professor Moshe Halbertal, but I didn't have a chance to read it before this year, so I'm not sure if what he says there will help us in this regard. But my point here is to say that all of these are cases of uncertainty. And in many cases of doubt, Judaism in fact says, going back to Ellen's point, that we use personal judgment. You are entitled to say, I think, essentially. And when I first realized that, it actually took me by surprise. I had written up this entire shiur, and then it realized that so much of this really revolves around this one point, and I had to rewrite everything I had done, which is good, because it's better now than it would have been. But the fact is that Jewish law incorporates personal judgment as a key component of halacha, of Jewish law. You can't have Jewish law without it, and I'll explain what I mean by that. In some cases, mitzvot actually require personal judgment. Personal judgment is a natural component of the mitzvah. I'll give you examples here, and I brought you sources on the sheet that I'm not going to read out loud, because it's a 90-minute class and I got like 40-something sources, but they're there in order that people should be able to see the authentic original that I'm drawing on. But as an example, rabbinical courts empower an apotropos, a legal guardian, to take care of the property of someone who lacks capacity, perhaps minor orphans, for example. That legal guardian is going to be responsible to make decisions about investment and protection of the assets. As I brought you in source number 4, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says you try to get an apotropos, a guardian who is somebody of substance, somebody who knows how to engage in business, somebody who will be able to take care of their stuff, but that guardian is going to have to exercise personal judgment in cases of uncertainty. You have a judge in a rabbinical court, and that's the next source that I brought, source number 5 on the sheet, who is responsible to come up with pshara, to come up with a settlement between litigants. The job of the judge is to perform a balancing act to figure out what is right. Or let's take cases that don't reduce as easily to simple sources. The job of a parent as a mechanech to educate your children. Lots of uncertainty in that regard. There are all sorts of mitzvot in which we are called upon to use our personal judgment as part of the mitzvah. There are other cases in which fulfilling a mitzvah requires a personal assessment of circumstances in order to decide whether and how to perform the mitzvah. So to give you examples of that, let's take an easy one. It's Sukkos in Toronto. It's cold out. Maybe there's a little bit of a mist. Do I sit in the sukkah? Do I not sit in the sukkah? You can look at the standards in the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah all you like. Right? Is there rain dripping into your soup? Is there whatever? At the end of the day, this is a judgment call to decide what to do. And that's what you're expected to do. There are certain laws in Judaism that pivot based on whether a person would suffer a significant loss by deciding one way or the other. What constitutes a significant loss? It's a judgment call. And so on. I have a list of like a dozen examples of this. In source number 6, I noted you a passage we've discussed in other classes where the Talmud indicates that you're allowed to enter into danger in order to pursue a parnasa, in order to make a living. How much danger are you allowed to engage in? How much is too much? A lot of that is personal judgment. The decision of whether to fast on Yom Kippur or not. Is somebody healthy enough to be able to fast? There's so much in Judaism, either directly or indirectly, that revolves around a person's own discretion. Where we are summoned to exercise personal judgment, having training and certification, which we mentioned before, will help us to exercise that judgment. Sometimes there are positions like that where you're able to call on somebody who has expertise. And that's certainly true when we're dealing with medicine. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 8. Yeah, number 8's the one that I want here. Someone sent me an email a while back in response to something from a shiur or something I had written, I forget, arguing that Jewish law does not necessarily trust medical opinion. So I did what you're supposed to do in a case like that. I brought him the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Take a look at the following 3 examples from very different areas of Jewish law. Source number 8. The question of whether to violate Shabbat to save someone's life if somebody is in danger, says Rabbi Yosef Karo, Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, Kocholi Sha'arofim Omrim Shu Sakana, when doctors say something is dangerous, Mechalam Olavas HaShabbos, you violate Shabbos. You turn to the doctors to be the ones to make that determination. Now, there are nuances. What if the doctor says you don't need to, but the patient knows his own health? There are nuances in the application. But the fundamental principle is that we go back to the doctor to ask that question. That's a simple case. That's one I think people are aware of. Case number in source number 9 is a different story. The Talmud discusses the case of what's called a shchiv mera. Shchiv mera means somebody who is on their deathbed. They give a deathbed gift. They want to give away all their assets. The assumption is someone who wants to give away a gift like that is doing so because they think they're going to die, right? That's a fair assumption. That's why somebody would give such a gift. So what happens if they give that gift thinking that they're going to die and then they survive? Now what do you do? They thought they were dead. Now it turns out that they're not. Is the gift valid or not valid? Sorry, Sharon, what?
It says it's void, automatic
right.
Void.
The gift is void, correct, as brought in the Shulchan Aruch here, as brought in source number 9, the gift is void. What happens if the person is on their deathbed, they have a particular illness, they give away all their property, they write it away to somebody, then they seem to have gotten better, and then they die. Right? You are familiar with the Lazarus effect, that maybe before dying they actually get a little stronger for some period of time, and then they pass away. I don't know if they passed away from the original disease or not. Says the Shulchan Aruch in source number 9, who does the evaluation? You go to the doctors. Right? You trust the doctors to give you that answer. They're the ones who are the authority. And then a third one in a very different area of Jewish law in source number 10. There is a rule that when somebody needs to go to mikvah, they're supposed to make sure that there is no interruption between their body and the water. So, for example, hair should not be very tangled. So Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Code of Jewish Law, quotes a discussion that goes back a couple of centuries before him to the Ma'ariv Kolon. The following case, we have a lot of doctors on this. We have 96 people, 96 Zoom screens anyway on this. Maybe somebody can explain to me what the medical reality he's talking about is. There's a woman whose doctor says that she should not wash her hair with water, but only with wine. Anybody have any idea why a doctor would suggest that? Well, I don't know.
Beer, but not wine.
Beer, right. I don't know. There's no beer here. This is a wine thing. I don't know. This is 13th or 14th century Spain that the Rama is quoting. The Ma'arik. I think it's 14th. So what in the world, is this about? I don't know. But that's what happened. And the problem is this woman needs to go to mikvah. And she's concerned that if she washes her hair with wine, maybe it's going to be a little sticky and therefore there's an interruption for blocking the flow of the water. So the Shulchan Aruch, or not Shulchan, the Rama, Rabbi Yisraelis, says, ask the doctors what the effect of wine is on the tangling of the hair. So apparently now they also have to know that. If they don't, then he has procedures. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that the Code of Jewish Law is adamant that we trust the discretion of doctors more so than the discretion of others. So much so that if doctors make a mistake, they are indemnified more so than most other certified experts. I brought you sources on this in source number 11 and in source number 12 from the Tosefta, a body of text that is parallel to the Mishnah, canonized slightly later, in which we talk about doctors being protected from liability in rabbinic courts if they make a mistake. We discussed that a lot more in a session, 8 or 9 years ago on medical malpractice. If you flip to the end of the source sheets for a moment, you'll see the next to last section after source 43. I gave you links for past sessions that we're going to just reference in the course of this session. So the first one there is a session we did on medical malpractice. For those who want more, you can look there. But the knowing now that, and I'm putting the link for the sheet in the chat one more time, knowing that the medical expert's personal discretion is significant in Jewish law, now let's look at these cases of doubt that we've raised in our four vignettes. Yes, Sharon, go ahead.
If you look at Helen's predicament, okay, her medical expertise, her knowledge tells her that she really doesn't have to isolate. So why is she isolating? I mean, so if you go by the medical expert and your own opinion and she knows she hasn't done anything and her son was vaccinated, she hasn't come in contact with anything, why is she isolating?
Great. So that's actually part of what we have to deal with in that first vignette. In the framing that I gave it in the first vignette, it's a question of the dentist talking about the other patients who were in the practice at the same time as Jill, right? That's why I put it there. So she's speaking about somebody other than herself. But the same question could have been asked. Let's say Jill says, Sarah says, I didn't see Jill. Jill wasn't my patient. I was in a different part of the practice. It shouldn't affect me at all. You could ask the same question as what you're asking about Ellen, just, translate it a little bit to a different case. So that's our first vignette. How much are we willing to trust the statement of the medical expert, the medical practitioner?
Can I
You know, Rose, I'm actually going to go a little further at this point. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I make one point or not?
Go for it. Make one point.
Okay. You know, with COVID, we know that 99%, it's 10 days, right? Very, very, very small percentages are going to get it 11, 12, 30, and 14 days. Having said that, if that's the rule that the government makes, we cannot all break the rule, because everybody then will, it'll be a free-for-all. That's what I want to say.
Okay.
Not because I believe it should be 14 days.
Okay, we're going to come back to it. Hang in there. We're not done. We're just getting started. So if you take a look on your sheets, what I tried to do here, we're up to source number 13, is to first address it from a public health perspective. And the public health protocols take this out of the hands of the individual practitioner. First of all, don't worry about Jill. Jill is going to suffer no harm through the close contact identification process. If you take a look at source number 13, this is not about COVID. This is in general, the Ontario Personal Health Information Protection Act. A health information custodian may disclose personal health information about an individual if the custodian believes on reasonable grounds that the disclosure is necessary for the purpose of eliminating or reducing a significant risk of serious bodily harm to a person or group of persons. So the default is we're not disclosing Jill's identity. We may say to a dozen people, you were there at the same time that somebody was, but we're not telling people that it was Jill. Jill's name is not allowed to be disclosed, and I brought you in source number 14 from the Ontario Human Rights Commission dealing with COVID specifically. It is particularly important that medical information is handled in a way that maximizes confidentiality. When necessary, employers should only disclose that an unnamed employee has tested positive for COVID-19. Any information that can identify the employee should not be disclosed to other employees unless there is an urgent health and safety justification to do so at that time. So we're not disclosing Jill's name, certainly, to the other patients, probably not even to other staff who were there, as much as just to say to them, you know, there was a patient who was there when you were working. We're not disclosing the identity. That's number one. Number two, in terms of the tracing process and the other patients, public health is going to be the one to handle this. It's not left to the discretion of Sarah. Source number 15 from the Ontario Ministry of Health. I learned so much about the structure and the hierarchy. I could tell you all about the Ministry of Health and Public Health Ontario and all these things. All public health units, it's talking in this source number 15, it's from a document that's describing the roles of different health units. So all public health units have the following role: to conduct COVID-19 case management for all probable and confirmed cases as described in this document, including initial telephone calls to cases, monitoring of cases until cleared from self-isolation, and updating case status as required. And that's actually not the part of the document that I wanted to bring. The part I wanted to bring was the rest of it, which follows that, which is talking about how they're also responsible for the contact tracing piece of it. It's not just about the monitoring of cases, but it's also about tracing. That is their responsibility, and you do see it in source number 16. Barry has a note in the chat, which I just noticed. Note, reasonable, not reasonable, and probable, a different standard than the Health Promotion and Protection Act. Right, he's pointing out the distinction in the language that's used for when you're justified in disclosing somebody's name. The language in the Ontario Personal Health Information Protection Act is reasonable grounds that the disclosure is necessary, versus in the Human Rights Commission, which says there's an urgent health and safety justification. Oh, you're looking at 15. Probable and confirmed? Barry, you'll have to speak up to let me know what you're talking about.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
No, sorry. The Health Protection and Promotion Act that specifies how public health organizations what standard public health organizations have to have in order to make an order about a communicable disease or, you know, force certain things is reasonable and probable, which means it has to be, you know, more than likely to occur, as opposed to in personal health protection, it just has to be reasonable. So it's actually a significantly lower standard, meaning it's more permissive.
Interesting. Okay, thank you. If you take a look at source number 16 from the Government of Canada, it is important for frontline healthcare providers to notify public health authorities of cases of COVID-19 in accordance with jurisdictional reporting requirements. Public health authorities need to provide overall coordination with healthcare providers and provincial laboratories for the management and reporting of cases, and to establish communication links with all involved healthcare providers for the full duration of illness. So the public health authorities are the ones who are handling this. The frontline healthcare worker is supposed to provide them with the information, and they do the contact stuff, and it's not for the healthcare worker to decide who is at risk. Sarah is correct that if they didn't do aerosol-generating procedures, and if they had everybody sequestered in their own area, and if they did all the tests when people came in, and all the proper hand-washing and hygiene procedures, which, by the way, if you look at source number 17, I gave you some links where you can find out more about those procedures, then it's true, others may really not be at risk. Nonetheless, Sarah is required to leave this up to the public health protocols. What about Jewish law? What will halacha have to say? So in terms of reporting the name, it's very clear that we avoid a disclosure of names in Jewish law, if at all possible. I brought you source number 18, the classic line in the Talmud, which says, somebody tells you information about themselves, you are not allowed to tell it to somebody else until they say, go tell it. So when Hashem speaks to Moshe, Hashem tells Moshe information and then says, now go tell it. Otherwise, he's not allowed to. So that even if somebody tells me something that I feel is benign, I don't think it's an issue, nonetheless, I am not allowed to disclose that to other people. This is what we call in Judaism, what halacha? What's the name of this law? What's this law called? Oh, I know that there are at least a few people there who know. Nope, not Lashon Hara. Rechilus. Correct, Rechilus. The Lashon Hara is if it's negative. Rechilus says, I'm not allowed to spread information about somebody even if it's not negative. Doesn't make a difference. It's true that there are certain social norms which allow for conveying information. So you hear that somebody lost a relative. It's not on them to now inform the entire world. It's reasonable to say they would want their friends to be aware of what happened and when the funeral is and whatever. But generally speaking, we don't disclose information. However, in the event that there is an important benefit to society from that, you need to protect other people, then as the Chafetz Chaim famously says in source number 19, I shouldn't say famously, but I think it's relatively well known, then you do indeed disclose it. So the classic example is, you know somebody's about to go into business with someone else, you know that that prospective business partner was convicted and served jail time for embezzling, so it's appropriate to make that known to this party with precautions. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the Chafetz Chaim, in source number 19 says you got to be really careful when disclosing that. You can only disclose that which you know personally or have had verified authoritatively. You can't jump to conclusions. You have to look for other ways besides disclosing the information to prevent harm. Make sure you don't magnify things beyond what you actually know, right? You want people to believe you, so you start building it up. Make sure you don't have a personal agenda, something to gain, and make sure the harm that's going to be caused is commensurate with whatever the wrongdoing was. These are important principles. It's true that I may be obligated to tell, but you have to do so carefully. So from a Jewish law perspective, we're very happy that Jill's name is going to be kept quiet. But let's get to the real question here. Does Sarah the dentist have any discretion about reporting names? Knowing that she's going to create difficulty for all those people who are going to be labeled close contacts and be in isolation for 2 weeks. So I would make 2 points. Number one, the obvious, we have an imperative to tell in order to save lives. Right? We have numerous instructions. A lot of you have been through, I don't know how many classes where we've discussed this. We have numerous instructions in the Torah about the importance of making sure to take care of the health of others and to protect their lives. I brought you one in source number 20. Lo sa'amod al dam rayacha. Do not stand by as your peer's blood is shed. that means that you see somebody drowning, attacked by animals, attacked by bandits. You have to do something in order to save them. We have numerous other sources that mandate that you save them as well. I'm not going to go through it right now just because it's such a basic principle and we've discussed it many times. But this is a very serious thing. I'll tell you something that I heard directly from Rav Herschel Schechter. I was on a call with Rav Schechter in which we asked him the following question. In the event that a school gets information on Friday afternoon, or let's say, actually the question was put a little bit differently. There's a case in a school of a potential infection, and the information is going to come back on Shabbos itself about whether the test was positive or not. If the information comes back on Shabbos, do you do contact tracing on Shabbos? And his answer was, you're saving lives. Granted that we will try to reduce it by having someone who isn't Jewish do it, taking care to do it in rabbinically prohibited ways instead of biblically prohibited ways. But he said you do contact tracing on Shabbos. We take that very, very seriously. But your professional medical judgment says that there's no risk involved. I think that what we said about discretion establishes that you as a medical professional have the right to make such an assessment. That is certainly true. However, this is where our second point comes into play. And this is what Rosie anticipated before. We have a principle in Jewish law called Dina Demalchusa Dina. The law of the land is the law. Now, in truth, there is debate in Judaism as to how far that goes. Meaning, everybody recognizes there are limits to that license. On the one hand, it's very clear in Jewish law, based on cases in the Talmud, the government has the right to tax the population. So that's clearly in the government's authority. On the other hand, it is equally obvious that if the government says every Wednesday all citizens have to eat a ham sandwich, that's not within the government's authority. The government does not have the right to legislate that I have to violate Jewish law. Those who saw my email earlier today about medical assistance in dying, we can have that conversation another time. The government does not have the authority to mandate that I violate that I violate Jewish law. But what about in the middle? What about what we're talking about here? Does the government have the ability to say to me, your personal medical judgment is that this person is safe? Nonetheless, we insist that you report to us. So take a look at source number 21, please. Rabbi Moshe Isserles writing in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. And here I'm just going to use my English translation. You can see the original Hebrew as well. He says, some say that we don't say the law of the land is the law, other than in taxes and tariffs which are tied to land, for the king decrees they may not live in his land, other than in this way. Meaning, some say the reason why government has authority is because they own the land. Therefore, their rights extend, the government's rights extend to things that are tied to the land. They can tax people. They can demand tariffs. But not beyond that. But then he continues to say, some disagree and argue that we say the law of the land is the law. Sorry, that's a mistake in my translation, writing too quickly. But the law of the land is the law in all matters. And the Ramah, Rabbi Isserles, goes with the more expansive view. And I gave you an illustration of that in source number 22, where he talks about the obligation to return lost objects and how that applies to items that were given to a craftsman to fix. I'm going to, in the interest of time, not go through all of the discussion there. But the point that I brought it for, and you can see it when you look in the source itself, is to say that Rabbi Isserles argues for an expansive version of the authority of the government. And on that basis, what they say regarding healthcare is also going to be the law, because that's part of what government does. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg addressed this issue in source number 23 when he stated, it was so obvious to halachic authorities. He's talking about the issue of governments paying for healthcare. And he says, it was so obvious to halachic authorities that there is such a duty to pay for an ill person's treatment upon all of those around the ill person. Everyone in society has a duty to try to help pay for somebody's medical bills. to the point that the sages debated the case in which the community had spent for this without asking the ill person. Is the ill person obligated to repay them, since they were obligated to do this? What Rabbi Waldenberg says in source number 23, I'm trying to slow myself down a little bit to explain this. Rabbi Waldenberg makes the statement that the obligation to pay for other people's medical needs is so strong that if somebody was ill and other people stepped in and pay their bills, the argument can be made that that person doesn't need to pay them back. God willing, they get better. They don't need to pay it back. Why? Because everyone was obligated to do that. They were obligated to help out. And he says this is certainly true for government. Based on what has been said, it is clear and simple that the government, which must have the health of society as its top concern, must also allocate funds to help prevent the development of this disease. He's dealing with an issue of vision problems by providing the necessary treatment via expert doctors. Rabbi Waldenberg's point is to say that the government should be involved in making sure that people have proper health care. And the reason I quote this here is to say health legislation is very much within the government's set of responsibilities. And therefore, when the government says you have to report, the answer is you have to report. That's the way it works. And so if you take a look at source number 24, Rav Herschel Schechter was quoted in an article in 2001 saying, this is dealing with vaccination, obviously a long time before COVID. Rav Schechter also asserted that where vaccines are mandated by the state, such as in the case of immunizations before entering school, one will be obligated to be immunized based on the concept of dina demachusa, dina, the law of the land is the law. So what emerges from our first vignette is that yes, doctors have a lot of discretion. They're able to make determinations and those determinations will be substantive and will have a very real halachic weight to them. Nonetheless, when it comes to not reporting, number one, we have a high threshold for deciding not to report because we are expected to look out for the health of others. And number two, the law of land is the law. If the government says we just want you to turn over the names, then that becomes your duty. Are we clear? Okay.
Sounds very much like Rabbi Waldenberg agrees with socialized medicine.
Yes, he does. We had a session on this in December of 2019. We had a session on communal spending for healthcare. We're actually due to do a part two at some point because we didn't finish all of the whole thing. But yes, he is. His view of socialized medicine is that the government is like the set of individuals. And just like individuals have to look out for each other, the government has to look out for everyone. There are other logics behind it, but that's his, that is his approach.
There is a, when you go to a dentist now, you have to, they take your temperature and everything else, but you have to sign a waiver saying that if there is something that happens in the, that they can report you. And they can give your name away. So that's in essence the same thing as you've said as well. It's an overarching principle. The other thing is that your dentist there, Sarah, may not have known that the two sat with each other in the waiting room or nearby to each other in the waiting room. They may have been worked on in different parts of the office. So there are circumstances beyond her knowledge that the law of the land and all these principles that you've shown are very valid.
Right. Thank you. And you're right. The fact of the matter is you may miss something, and trusting in your own instincts in a case that involves potential life and death is a very dangerous game. This is certainly true. Jack asks me about communal responsibility and some of the nuances. I'd refer you back to that shiur. Maybe what I'll do is when I send out the follow-up email, I'll also include a link to that, because it's not one of those that I thought to include at the end of this source sheet. So maybe I'll send out the link for it. But it's called Communal Spending for Healthcare. You can find the recording on YU Torah. Also a note, since a lot of people have, again, been joining all along, if you didn't sign in advance, please make sure to send me your name. And if you didn't get the emails advertising this class, make sure to include your email address. Definitely if you want credit, but even if you don't want credit, to give you notification of future classes and follow up from this session, it's important that I have your name and email. Okay. Vignette number two, correcting dangerous conduct or reporting dangerous conduct. That's our case in which there is somebody who is not masked properly, working at a working at a health practice. I'm just going to give everybody the default mute. There we go. There is somebody working at a health practice who is not properly properly masked. It is reported to the physician who's heading the practice, and the physician doesn't do anything about it. What do you do next? Do you say, too bad, I guess, I tried, it didn't work? Do you say something? What exactly do you do? What are your thoughts?
Hi, it's Andrea. This is a occupational health and safety matter as well as a medical matter, because where you feel you're working in an unsafe environment, if your boss or your supervisor doesn't take it seriously, I don't know the setting of this of the medical office, but if there's somebody above them, then you can go to them. Or if there's nobody at your center that you can report it to, you can report it to the occupational health and safety officer with the government, and you can actually refuse to work if you are in an unsafe environment.
Mm-hmm. All true. All very true. Is there any concern that maybe telling is somehow inappropriate?
No, but if he likes his job, he may not have one at the end of the day. If he complains to the boss again, he may have to choose between his health and what the boss says.
A fair point.
Back is not going to be keen. Hopefully, wherever he runs with this, is going to be shrewd enough not to tell the source when they walk in the door, yes, this person is not using the mask properly.
I
For example, it's below your nose and you think you're wearing a mask. For example, you sling it over your ear and you touch the outside. For example, crumpling it in your pocket, then putting back on and having the droplets on your hand.
Yeah, no, these are all good examples. Or bad examples, depending on how you look at it. Sharon and then Rose, I saw you both wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, this is a Jewish institute or a Jewish practice or whatever. I don't think anybody would look happily on calling in public health and calling the institution on. I think he should complain again to the doctor that dismissed him and say, listen, I don't want to call public health. You have to do something about this. Mm-hmm. But you don't air your dirty laundry in public if you can avoid it.
So Sharon points out the bias that we have to try and handle things in-house, and I'm going to come back to that because that's a very, very important point in this conversation. Rose, you were going to say?
So the point that I'm making is if the person who's in charge of him is careless about this, he'll probably be careless about other things, which puts the person at risk not only for the mask. The mask is just a symptom of a bigger picture.
Potentially, I'd agree.
It's difficult because I don't want to give you other examples that could be terribly harmful that you wouldn't think about. I mean, now we're thinking about masks. So I think he should readdress it. And if it isn't dealt with, then he has a dilemma.
Right.
Although he will probably get fired anyway, the poor guy.
Manny, you were going to say? Or are you just unmuted?
I was going to say, I would, if it was me, like, recommending to this Jonathan, I would tell him to go directly to the guy and speak with him directly.
Mm-hmm.
In a respectful way, point out to him that he's not wearing his mask in a correct way, and it's potentially dangerous for the rest of the staff in the office.
Have you ever done that? I shouldn't ask that question personally. Can you imagine somebody doing that? It's a very difficult thing to do.
I've done it so
Yes, I have done that sort of stuff in my office.
Okay.
I've done that sort of thing in my office. If I've seen somebody, but I'm the boss, so it's not so fair.
It's not difficult.
If somebody else, a secretary in my office.
Okay.
Let me ask, how many patients do you have offices check PPE? How often do we go? You've done it, you've taught the staff, and then they make mistakes and they become careless. How often do we go back and say, okay, let's do a drill for PPE? It's the same thing, right?
Okay, Alana?
I wonder though, did you set it up that Jonathan is a new employee
and he's a receptionist because maybe he's kind of low man on the totem pole. So there's definitely a power imbalance for him to go to one of the physicians. So it's all well and good to say, well, he should go and he should talk to him respectfully and directly. But it's, you know, in terms of power imbalances, it would be very hard for him to do, I think.
Yes.
In a medical hierarchy kind of a setting.
Yep. No, and I thank you for calling attention to the artistry of my vignettes. yes, that was intentional. But I heard some people here, I heard Leia comment, I heard others comment that they do in fact, correct it. I think a lot depends on the setting. A lot depends on the relationship. So let's talk about what happens here. So first of all, from a public health perspective, having asked public health officials what would happen, from what I understand, it's not likely that reporting this is going to result in any sort of penalty for the person whose mask is not fit properly. They may get a phone call with instructions about doing things properly, but no one is actually going to get harmed as a result of the report, again, other than possibly the one making the report. But the person whose mask isn't fit well, you know, is unlikely to be harmed. But let's walk it through halachically. Let's say there was a potential for harm. So at first read, based on the things we've already said, it seems that you do report. We've already established the authority of the medical establishment to declare medical reality and to say masks are necessary, they have to fit this way, and so on. We have already established that government has the authority in Jewish law to establish health protocols as the law of the land. So that's automatic. You're gonna have to accept that. But what about the issue that Sharon raised, which I'm gonna give the formal halachic title of Mesira. Mesira literally meaning handing over Jews to those who are not Jewish, where they could get harmed. It actually comes up, the original context for the law of Mesira was concerned that people would turn over the assets of others within the community to those who would then take them. The Talmud in Gittin, in source number 25, gives the following exchange. Take a look. Two sages are talking. This takes us back to sometime in the Roman period. Mar Ukva sent to Rabbi Elazar. There are people who stand against me. I could give them to the throne. What should I do? I've got people who are giving me a really hard time. And I could turn them over. I have contacts. Can I do that? Rabbi Elazar writes back to him, it is written, I guarded my path from sinning with my tongue. I muzzle my mouth when the wicked are still opposite me. He quotes him a pasuk, a verse. And he says, even though the wicked are opposite me, I will muzzle my mouth. I'm not going to say anything. Keep quiet, he says. Don't turn them over to the government. Mar Ukva sent back, you know, they're causing me great pain. I can't manage them. I can't deal with it. To which he says back, be silent for God and hope for him. And it's a play on words in the Hebrew, hitcholel lo, God will make them chalalim. God will make them corpses. Meaning, you don't turn them over to the government. Rise early, stay late in the study hall. They'll disappear on their own. But you don't turn them over. And that philosophy is one that we've had in Jewish law down through the ages. I brought you Rambam, Maimonides, in source number 26. One may not hand a Jew to the control of the nations, whether physically or financially, even where he's wicked and a sinner, even where he causes them trouble and pain. Anyone who gives a Jew to the nations, whether physically or financially, has no share in the next world. So on that basis, do you say, don't report? However, the answer is, do report. And I say that for two reasons. First of all, just for those who are curious, because this question always comes up when you talk about Mesira, if you go to the last page of the packet, you will see there a link to a class I gave, I don't know, 2016, I think, on reporting child abuse. And you will find there ample sources to say you absolutely 100% are obligated to report. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. You do make that that report. But going back to our issue at hand here, if we believe that people's health is at risk, then this is also not a question. You do report for two reasons. Number one, a person who is endangering the health of others is what we call a rodef, a pursuer. They are putting other people in danger. And we have a principle. I'm just going to default mute everybody because I'm getting background noise. We have a principle in Jewish law found in source number 27 from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, that if you see somebody being pursued, matzilin oso, you save him, afilu benefesh harodeif, even if that means taking the life of the pursuer. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach made an interesting point on that in source number 28. He dealt with the following question. It's all well and good to say that when I see somebody running after somebody else with a gun drawn, that I can assume this is a bad situation. This is a dangerous situation. I better stop the guy who's running after him. Again, assuming he's not a police officer, fine, all the different caveats. But where it's clear cut, it's clear cut. But the majority of cases are not clear cut. What do you do if you're not sure? And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach argued in source number 28, based on biblical precedent, the Torah talks about the case of a baba machteres. Somebody breaks into a house during the night. We work with the assumption that the home invader would kill the homeowner in the event that the homeowner were to oppose him. That's the assumption that we make, and therefore, the homeowner is entitled to kill a person invading the home. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, you don't know that this person would kill, but you're allowed to make reasonable assumptions. And the same thing is going to apply in our discussion and say, even though you're not sure, you're not certain, nonetheless, what you know about masks is that they are important. What you know is that when people are in close quarters and they're not protected from airflow, the disease is communicable. What you know is that everybody at this point locally is in a cohort of people among whom COVID is found. Therefore, you have a responsibility to act. That's number one. And it's not like you're killing the person, right? What you're doing is reporting it for them to be corrected. That's really what you're talking about. That's number one. But number two, even if they were to be censured for it, the secular government has the authority, as far as Jewish law is concerned, to set criminal laws and to set punishments. And the best example of this is a passage in the Talmud, which I brought you in source number 29. The story is a very ironic story because it involves Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon. Who was Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon's father? Don't say Rabbi Shimon. Who was Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon's father? Who's buried in Grant's tomb? No, who is the father of Rabbi...
Bar Yochai.
Yeah, thank you. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who had to live in a cave for 12 years because the Romans were after him, right? And his son was actually with him. Rabbi Elazar was with him in the cave. So keep that in mind as you read the following story. Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, gave the following advice to a government police officer, detective, whatever he was. You want to catch criminals? Go into the pub in the fourth hour of the day. When you see someone drinking wine, holding a cup, and dozing, ask about him. If he's a scholar and he's dozing, so it's because he got up early to study. If he's a worker, say he rose early for labor. If he works at night, perhaps he works with fine metal and that's why nobody hears the sounds of his work, right? So fine, he was awake all night working and that's why he's so tired. But if you don't have any excuse, the guy's a thief and you can catch him. I'm going to leave it to those who are in, you know, police school, so to speak, to determine the efficacy of this strategy. But it worked in Roman times, apparently, because they were really impressed. Word of this was brought to the government, and they said, let the reader of the scroll be the one to carry it out. He's so sharp, he's got such ideas, let's hire the man. And they brought Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, the former fugitive from the Romans, and he became an agent of the Roman government to catch thieves. And not just any thieves, but this is within the Jewish community, is what we're talking about. So Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha sends a message to him. Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha may have been a codename for Rabbi Akiva. It may have been the son of Rabbi Akiva. There's a lot of discussion about that. But he says to him, vinegar, son of wine, right? Your father was great. You've gone bad. How long will you pass the nation of our God to be murdered? To which he said, I'm just eliminating thorns from the vineyard. To which the response is, well, let God worry about that. Let the owner of the vineyard come and eliminate the thorns. So there's a lot of discussion, obviously, about this. But I wanted to show you how Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet invoked this Gemara in source number 30. He's talking about the issue of turning somebody over to the secular government and following their rules. And he says, if the witnesses in a particular case are credible to the selected judges, they may fine the person, the defendant, financially, punish him physically, all according to what appears to them. This upholds the world. In other words, what he's saying, I should give a little bit more background, is that you can go beyond the basic laws of the Torah. The judges have discretion to transcend that as they feel necessary. If you were to establish everything on the basis of biblical law, if you were to require biblical witnesses and warnings and all of those things, and you would not punish other than as the Torah does for injuries and the like, the world would be ruined. We would require witnesses and warnings. He says the Torah's standards for what it takes to carry out biblical punishment are too restrictive. We're not going to get anywhere. Sometimes, he says, you need to institute new laws. And then he says, certainly where there is government license, like in the case of Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon in Bava Metzia, the case we just read in source number 29, he says, the government has the authority to establish these rules. Ah, then why was why did Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha rebuke Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon? Says the Rashba, says Rabbi Ibn Aderet, because it's not a pious thing to do, perhaps. But it's absolutely considered appropriate to do so. I brought you Rabbi Herschel Schechter again in source number 31, in which he says, there is no problem of Mesira in informing the government of a Jewish criminal, even if they penalize the criminal with a punishment more severe than the Torah requires, because even a non-Jewish government is authorized to penalize, to punish and penalize above and beyond the law for the purpose of maintaining law and order. That's the position Rav Schechter takes. Rabbi Usher Weiss has a similar position, which I brought you part of in source number 32, when he says the person who hands somebody over is not really pursuing them, is not really harming them. It's a discretionary issue, and it's an appropriate thing to do. I have more sources from Rabbi Weiss on this. I'm not going into it right now. The point that I'm trying to make is that you would indeed report. If you feel people are in danger, you made the important steps of trying everything possible first to correct things, whether personally or with the people within the practice. You're not getting anywhere, and you know for sure that this is a problem, then you turn the person over. Let's move to vignette 3, because I just looked at the clock. I realize it's 8:45. So vignette number 3, refusing to see patients when the government thinks you could see them. So what kind of flexibility do you have in that regard to decide, I don't want to see patients? What would you say? Is that within a doctor's right? Or any medical professional, not just doctors?
I would.
I would what? I would decline to see patients.
I would decline to, since the beginning of the pandemic, I've not seen information. I do it all by phone, and I do a pretty good job, I believe. But why should I expose myself with my age and my comorbidities and that of my assistant and my wife to something that can be avoided?
I definitely hear you.
And listen, we have FaceTime, we have WhatsApp, we have Zoom. All kinds of ways that you can almost do that. So yeah, it can be done. And it's a little overreaching that you must this or that.
Okay. Sharon, you were going to say?
Well, I think that it's a personal decision. If you think that your risks are great, then you should not see patients. Most of us are fee-for-service. There are people that are, you know, I forget what the word is, that they got their patients all registered. But most of us are fee for service, and we're going to take a hit. We're just not going to be paid for it. There is a
Being dead is a long-term commitment.
True.
Yes.
I mean, I see about 20% of my patients, and they're all, if I don't think that I can do them service on the phone, then I'll see them. Don't like to.
Okay. Dan, you're going to say? No.
Okay.
Okay. So from a public health perspective and from an Ontario regulation perspective, the government doesn't require you to see people. If you take a look at source number 33 from the Government of Canada, COVID-19 pandemic guidance for the healthcare sector, HCWs, healthcare workers, who are unable, e.g. for health reasons, or unwilling to be directly involved with COVID-19 patients should be assigned supportive roles. So you take some other role. That's what you would do. And that's not just true for healthcare workers. That's also true for people in general, in any job. If they say they're concerned for COVID, the employer is not justified in dismissing them. From what I understand, each healthcare facility has the freedom to set its own standards for what it wants its employees to do. But fundamentally, you're not allowed to dismiss somebody because they are afraid of COVID. Now, from a Jewish law perspective, there is a potential duty to err on the side of seeing patients where they need it, because halacha will say that you have to do so. Meaning, halacha, as we said at the outset, accepts your assessment of your own risk. That's a basic principle. I added a couple of sources here, which I'm going to explain outside the text, but you can see them yourself, starting in source number 34. We do normally discount somebody's concern for personal bias. In other words, we normally are concerned about conflict of interest when you're going to judge your own risk. A judge is not allowed to hear a case in which the judge has personal interest. That's source number 34. A legal guardian for the property of someone who's incapacitated is not allowed to self-deal, right? That's a basic principle as well. So we do have concern for conflict of interest in general. However, Rav Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, also known as the Chazon Ish, made a very interesting point. He suggested that the limitation of conflict of interest in Jewish law is very narrow. It's only where we have specific statements within the traditional sources that say this is a conflict of interest. He points out that a rabbi who has a chicken at home and has a doubt about whether the chicken is kosher or treif is allowed to answer that question personally. We don't say, well, that's conflict of interest. He suggests, and I brought it for you in source number 36, that we don't extend the concern for conflict of interest beyond core sources. So therefore, I would say, a doctor is able to make the assessment of, is this dangerous? Is it not dangerous? However, and despite that, there is a bias in Jewish law for saying that healthcare workers are expected to see patients who need them, even at some level of risk. I brought you links and the next to last source to two discussions about this. One, a panel discussion I actually did with Barry Pacus and Dr. Brian Schwartz, who I think was on this call before, about Ebola in 2014, and then also the pandemic ethics session that we had last April, as well, in which we discussed this issue and we said that society needs healthcare workers to endanger themselves for the sake of the community. Meaning, if we have a situation in which healthcare workers are all going to say, this is dangerous, I can't do that, you won't have a healthcare system. And this is the point Rabbi Usher Weiss made in a video, which you can see the link for in source number 37, and it's based on source number 38. In source number 38, we learn a law regarding judges. And the question there is, if a judge has litigants approach him for a case, and he knows that one of the litigants is a dangerous guy, so is he able to recuse himself and say, actually, you know, I think I have a conflict of interest. I don't think I can hear this case, in order to get away from it. And the rule is that a judge who is publicly appointed is not allowed to walk away. Why? It's dangerous for him. He could get killed. Nonetheless, you need judges. So on that basis, Rabbi Weiss and Rabbi Avram Steinberg as well, in source number 39, takes the same position, says that the expectation indeed is that society needs healthcare professionals, and therefore they're willing to err on the side of risk. And historically, that's what happened. I brought you in source number 40 a link which may be illegal. I'm not 100% sure. Rabbi Shlomo Brody wrote an article several months ago called "Does Jewish Law Oblige Doctors to Risk Their Own Health?" But he wrote it for Mosaic. And Mosaic, unless you're a subscriber, goes behind a paywall or a subscription wall at a certain point. So when I looked for the article, I couldn't find it. However, I did find this link to it on colby.edu. They're archiving pandemic-related articles. So I'm not sure whether I'm telling you to use this article or not, but it's there. And what he does is he shows the history of application of this law in plagues and how some sages said yes and some did not regarding healthcare workers serving. I should note, very, very important point, which we stressed when we discussed this topic last April, which is the only way the healthcare worker would be expected to see the patients is with the basic standard of PPE. Meaning, if you don't have protective gear, no one is saying go out and get yourself infected. You have to meet the basic standard for protection. But if you have that, then we do err on the side of seeing the patient. However, I just oversimplified the case, right? Because the case wasn't really about the doctor being concerned about himself. The question was his pregnant wife. Does that make things more challenging? So if you take a look at source number 41 from the Association of Ontario Midwives, they inform us that pregnancy does not give an increased risk of contracting COVID-19, which may be reassuring. On the other hand, in the same source, they say that pregnant individuals are at increased risk of severe illness, meaning if they do become ill, it can be worse for them. So, Rose, I'm going to ask you to hold on to your thought for a minute. I know you want to say something. I can see it. But that's the medical reality is that there is greater risk once they are infected. So here I refer you back to what Rav Asher Weiss said back in April when we discussed this topic the first time, and he gave a case in which you have an EMT whose spouse has multiple sclerosis and is concerned about being at greater risk. And his answer was the EMT may not treat patients because of the danger to the spouse. You have the right to risk your life. You don't have the right to risk your spouse's life. And the same thing will be true if it's scientifically correct that a pregnant woman is at greater risk. And frankly, you could argue greater risk even just because of the stress of this and the fear of what if. You can make that argument. Then the answer is, then you don't see the patients. You are entitled to risk yourself. You're not entitled to risk your spouse. So what it really comes down to is, again, your discretion and your medical opinion in determining whether there's a risk to you and a risk to someone other than yourself. I have 5 minutes left, so what I want to do is the following. I want to do vignette 4, because it's a quick one, and then take questions and comments, and I'll stay beyond the time for people as well. So I see Jeffrey's iPhone has his hand up. Keep it up for a little bit longer. Vignette number 4. Seeing patients when the government says that it's not necessary. The government says do everything by telehealth if you can. You have geriatric patients, that was our vignette, and you think that it's important that they be seen in person for a variety of reasons. Perhaps you need to see them in person because they won't tell you everything, or they won't know what to tell you, but you'll pick it up when you see them. Maybe because of their mental health, it's a good idea. You give all sorts of precautions. What's the rule in such a case? So the truth of the matter is that public health says it's up to you to make that decision. In source number 42, the Ontario Ministry of Health says that certain patients and patient populations will be particularly burdened as a result of our health system's limited capacity to restart services. Our health system has a reciprocal obligation to ensure that those who continue to be burdened have their health monitored, receive appropriate care, and so on. You have to look out for those people who are most vulnerable. And if you think they need to be seen in person, then that's who you see in person. So when it comes to weighing the risk to yourself, that's relatively straightforward then. Just like we said in the third vignette, You calculate what the risk is to you. You figure out that you're safe, so see the patient. But it's very important to make one note regarding the health of the patient you are seeing. And that is, the patient you're seeing is likely to rely on your judgment in terms of what is safe for them. We had a discussion a ways back in terms of informed consent. And we noted what I brought you here in source number 43, which is that very often it's not consent, it's assent. The doctor says something and the patient takes that as sort of the bedrock of their conversation, and they're simply agreeing with what the doctor said. So even if you warn them of the risks and you advise them of the protocols, the patient really isn't able to make an intelligent decision on it. And therefore, it's very important that the medical practitioner recognize that and not just say, well, I think they should come in, and they're intelligent enough to make their own decision. You can't rely on that. You have to really think through what their circumstances are and what their vulnerabilities are when you make that assessment and when you invite them to come in. So I gave you a bunch of review questions on the sheet, which I'm going to go through really quickly, and then I'll take questions and comments. What are examples of cases in which mitzvah performance must rely on personal judgment? So I gave the case of the judge deciding on compromise, the guardian managing assets, the parent for the child. There are also cases in which personal judgment establishes how a mitzvah is to be performed, like deciding on pursuing a livelihood that may be dangerous, deciding whether to fast on Yom Kippur. We gave three examples to demonstrate that the code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, relies on medical opinion. One was violating Shabbos to save a life. One was evaluating a cause of death regarding financial issues that depend on it. And one was determining whether a woman is able to go to mikvah. In all three cases, we said go to the doctor. So we value medical opinion in Jewish law. Applying that to our vignettes, in the first case, reporting the patients who were present when somebody who tested positive was present. So we said, will public health take into consideration the dentist's personal contention? The answer is yes. They do have discretion in terms of deciding who is a close contact, and they may well consider the dentist's personal opinion. Jewish law, though, will not allow Sarah to say, therefore, I can just hold back the information. Dina de Malchusa, Dina, the law of the land is the law. You have to turn over the information and let public health work through it. Public health and halakha will each not endorse the release of the patient's name who tested positive. That's in terms of vignette number one. Vignette number two, reporting the uncooperative staff person with a poorly fitted mask. So we said that's not called misira. It is not prohibited, just the opposite. You're supposed to do it. The person who's wearing that mask in that way is potentially harming others, and the government reacts responsibly. This is what they're supposed to do, is to make such rules. In vignette number three, does public health require medical professionals to see patients during the pandemic? The answer is no. According to the Chazon Ish, we rely on a rabbi to give halachic answers regarding the rabbi's own kitchen because conflict of interest is not a broad thing. It only applies in very specific cases. And therefore, I can make the argument that the healthcare worker can make an assessment regarding personal risk. However, we want the healthcare worker, and that's the next question, to err on the side of caution for public health as opposed to personal health. We want to make sure there will be healthcare. Does pregnancy pose a greater risk for COVID-19? According to various studies, of which I brought you one example, not a greater risk of infection, but those infected may be worse off. And then finally, may a medical professional rely on the patient's judgment in deciding whether to come in? Not necessarily, because the patient is relying often on the medical professional. Okay, it's 9:01. I apologize for going a minute over, but I will now take questions and comments. And again, if you didn't sign in yet, if you didn't send me your name/email address, please make sure that you do so. Thank you, everybody, very much for participating. And now, Jeffrey first, because he had his hand up, and then Rose had a comment, and then others as well. Jeffrey. I'm not hearing you. Okay, Rose.
Oh, now. Yeah, now can you hear me?
Oh, now I hear you, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
Okay. So regardless of whether or not the pregnant person might have a greater risk, but is a doctor allowed to, you know, even just a non-pregnant spouse, a child, a parent living in the house to put someone else at risk? I'm sure you probably covered that last April.
Yeah, so it's not just about pregnancy. I mean, you heard the case from Roy Usher Weiss about multiple sclerosis. And it's not only limited to the spouse, it's other people who could be harmed within the household by this. So it's much broader. Yeah. Okay, Rose?
In terms of pregnancy, I mean, this is what I deal with. The first thing I want to say is perhaps the patient, if you take an absolute a pregnant patient compared to a normal population, perhaps they themselves, it's not clear whether they are at minimally increased risk. But having said that, the first 12 weeks of a pregnancy are terribly vulnerable because we don't actually know what the viral load will do to organogenesis. So in the first 12 weeks, it is critical that the patient be a pregnant person, stay away from anybody, and you could potentially give her that because we don't know the answer. In fact, there are some recommendations that patients say that you want to have IVF. They don't always listen. Maybe they should wait because of this virus, because we don't actually know. And then after the 12 weeks, at first it was thought that the placenta was a barrier and prevented the fetus from getting infected, but in actual fact, that is not the case in all of it, and you can get a cytokine storm, and you can get thromboembolic episodes, and I can go on and on and on about the things that can happen to patients who are pregnant. So they are at risk. However, I just wanted to say, they are at risk,
okay.
Bottom line.
Okay, I'm going to...
12 weeks organogenesis, it's critical.
I'm going to leave this to the medical professionals because that's where this belongs. But thank you for pointing it out, certainly in terms of your own medical expertise. Mark, you have your hand up.
For Basira, isn't it an important factor of whether we're dealing with a functional judiciary that we can trust as opposed to despots?
Yes. For more of a discussion of this, I refer you to the class on reporting abuse that I mentioned during the session. But yes, it's not only about the fact that government has the right to establish laws, but that we're talking about a society in which there's going to be a proper protocol followed. It doesn't have to be our protocol, two witnesses, the warnings, and so on. But there cannot be a sense that we're just handing the person over to people who will do random things to them. That is correct. There's someone who has signed in as Sheer who has their hand up.
Oh, hi, it's Pearl Cornflint from State, New Jersey.
Welcome.
I'm a physician kind of overseeing the whole COVID response for the VA system in New Jersey and New York. For the last case, I just wanted to say that we have found that virtual primary care is like the future, and that especially for our most elderly patients, our older patients who are most vulnerable and highest risk, that we're really careful not to bring them in unless we really have to. And even if we were to bring them in, we would do mostly everything on video and just bring them in for just exactly what they need for face-to-face. So I think the perspective is really not so much my own discomfort, but really what's best for the patient. And I think that's what we have to be thinking about, what is best for this patient. And it's really to keep them outside of facilities, outside of clinics, and in, you know, as much as possible, do video and only bring them in when you really have to.
Got it. Thank you. Hold on there for a minute. First, I wanted to just note, Barry posted a link in the chat for the survey. So those who had pre-registered got it in email. But if you only registered right before the session or during the session, then take a look at that. Just click on that. You'll be able to fill out the survey. But in terms of Pearl, to the points that you made, when you say it's the virtual or remote type of care is primary care of the future. You mean even post-pandemic?
Oh, yeah. I think that we're never going to go back to the way healthcare was in the past. I think that virtual care and most, like I know in Canada, they were mainly doing telephone visits. In New Jersey and in the United States, we're mainly doing video visits. But I would say that even once we're past COVID, we have found out that we can do a significant part of our care virtually, and I think there'll be a component of that. Hey, listen, an example of that is flu. So few people have gotten flu because we've been so careful with masking, hand washing, not coming in to aggregate settings, you know. So, and also we don't really know the future COVID? Is COVID going to be something one-time vaccine, you know, to you get your two shots? Or is it going to be like flu, where it'll be seasonal and new variants?
So right.
I would just say, yes, the future of primary care or specialty care, all care, will be virtual. Even pre-op visits will be virtual, and you'll just come in for your procedure.
Wow.
I think that is the future. And not only that, you can get on iPads peripherals like stethoscopes. You can get BP monitors. You can get WIC scales that auto-populate. I mean, that is the future. Soon your iPad will be able to give us all that information. You'll even be able to do an echocardiogram. So I think that this is the future.
Wow. Please don't step on your iPad thinking it's a scale. Just warning people. Okay.
Or don't be afraid by the number. It comes up, right?
Yes.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Other questions and comments? Okay. Then thank you very, very much. I will upload the recording and send out the link to the email list afterwards, God willing. I appreciate everybody spending the evening here. Be well, and have a good night, and stay safe.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thanks.